Welcome back to Tech Hygiene. We help you stay sane in a crazy world. Say hi to your hosts, John Biggs and Lauren Feltman.
Welcome back to Tech Hygiene. I'm John Biggs.
I'm Lauren Feltman.
And this is the show in which we explore technology at its peak. We're really peaking, ultimately, I think, as human beings. This is the end.
I think it's all downhill from here. We're peaking, tweaking, and twerking.
You've been doing a lot of outdoor work. I've seen your online videos.
Yes, I'm back to nature. My brother-in-law owns a garden center and a landscaping division. And he was putting some sod over. He had this little mini, I don't even know what it is. It was like a tank pickup, not tank.
Yeah, tractor. I saw it. It looked like a little ATV, but with like, you rode on it, like standing up.
Tons of fun. That's real hardware. When you say hardware, that's what I think of. I don't think of a server rack. I think of something with treads.
Well, that's the funny thing. Like I have an uncle who's a farmer in Poland, and he got a brand new tractor. He used to have like, I don't know, a Lubo tractor from Mother Russia circa 1975, which just basically had like a gas tank and an engine, and you just rode it around. And then he got this crazy tractor that is fully programmable. So it's designed to essentially do everything you want it to, I guess. But at that point, it wasn't even like, he didn't quite understand what to do with it. He didn't quite understand how to fix it. Everything changed almost overnight for him because of this one big change in terms of literally his farming hardware.
Well, you know what? I know this wasn't on topic for us, but it's worth discussing. John Deere, mm-hmm. right? The famous John Deere company. They've become basically a technology company, and they've been putting chips in their tractors for years. And farmers are freaking out because they can't repair them anymore. If you try to, it voids the warranty on mm-hmm. your $500,000 piece of equipment. John Deere makes like 40% of their revenue just on repairs. And there's actually a big market. I forgot what year they implemented it. I think it was early 80s. So maybe 70s. But those old John Deere's that a farmer could fix himself, and, mm-hmm. you know, are quite in demand. And they sue you. If you try and fix it, John Deere sues you. So it's really incredible.
So there's apparently a thing called a green board. So what they do is you basically – it's a – There's a vehicle bus. There's like a system inside the vehicle that connects all the little parts together. And I did a little research on this like a couple years ago, but because each of these pieces talks to each other, you can't just like swap out like I don't know the well I don't even know what you could swap out on this thing.
A carburetor.
Well, I mean it wouldn't even be like a carburetor. It'd be like a some kind of pressure valve or something like that that gives like a pressure signal. And because it's all completely controlled, you can't actually pull things out and plug them back in again. So in the way that like you're saying, like back in the old days, you would basically just like get a wrench and get into the engine. Now you can't. It's impossible, which is just wild.
Yeah, it's so un-American, and it's really disheartening, especially in that industry, which is, you know, salt of the earth kind of guys. You know, we're not talking about giant commercial farmers like, I don't know, like Dole or whoever, you know. We're talking about mom and pop farmers in the heartland, and they can't even fix their own equipment. Yeah. It's like they're being held hostage by technology.
Well, so, I mean, think about it. John Deere doesn't have that. So this is exactly the situation. We talked about this a little while ago, I think, where a piece of hardware basically is the hardware owner becomes dependent on this hardware company. And the primary reason for that is that you don't buy a John Deere tractor every year. And John Deere's pretty much they're probably saturated the market by now. So the only way to really make money year after year is to do exactly this, to have complete control over the piece of hardware. And you have to be completely dependent on the company itself to get you repairs, to get you parts, to get you manuals, all that other good stuff. It's a sad situation.
Instead of a planned obsolescence strategy, mm-hmm. it's a software lock-in. John Deere is like the Apple of tractors or something.
Yeah, exactly. So my favorite thing was this thing called a Nova. It was like It was a different company, Moment or Method or something like that. It's basically like a plastic box. You program it. It goes for like, I don't know, 10 hours at 160. You basically just set a timer, set a temperature. You used to be able to have recipes that you could say, so I want to do a steak medium well, so you press the button and does steak medium well. Now you have to pay to get the recipes, because the company realized that they weren't going to keep selling these devices over and over again, because nobody wanted to buy it once you get to a certain point in the life cycle. If you're early on and you're like Kickstarter life cycle, everybody wants to pick one up. It looks amazing. You get $1 million bucks in revenue a month or something insane like that. But once the market's saturated, you can't sell anymore. So there's really no way to, the only thing you can do is lock people in. And that's exactly what I emailed them. I'm like, hey guys, this is really dumb. It's not a good idea. And they're like, well, yeah, well, our investor made us do this, or else they're basically just going out of business.
Yeah, it's almost like you get punished in a way. The market punishes you for making a good product. You know what I'm saying? I mean, there are other companies. I mean, John Deere's always been known for quality. And as you mentioned, their products last, you know, 50 years or plus. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, and it's a weird dynamic in a way.
Yeah, I guess that's the answer.
Well, I would hope that John Deere would just think of other products or accessories or, you know, I don't know, a TikTok page, something other than screwing their loyal customers and, in most cases, multi-generational families and customers. It's just that never sat right with me, but no pun intended. I didn't want to get us off track.
Yeah, off-tractor. Right. Speaking of tractors, Bob Dylan sold his entire catalog. Who did he sell this to?
Universal Music.
Universal Music. Bob Dylan famously said for $300 million, he famously said that he never wanted to be in an underwear commercial. And first off, he was in an underwear commercial. And now Universal Media Group is basically going to put all his songs to, I don't know, I guess you could license it for commercials or cartoons or whatever the heck you want to do.
Yeah, they'll do reissues. They'll obviously license it like crazy. As you said, 600 songs, $300 million. Price sounds about right. I like Dylan. I'm a fan. Yeah. Of those 600 songs, maybe 20 are good.
Yeah.
The rest is just the mumbling Dylan stuff. It's interesting, though, because this seems to be the way we've spoken about content on the show many times, and this seems to be really popular now. Aside from Universal, one of the bigger companies is a British company called Hipgnosis, mm-hmm. and they spent $600 million last year. They bought Stevie Nicks' catalog for $80 million. Not even Fleetwood Mac, just Stevie Nicks.
Why? What are they going to do with these things?
I guess that they're in it for the long haul.
Yeah, I see. Okay, and
they're licensing it for commercials and, you know, film and whatever else.
No, there's...
The interesting thing is that these are really... Well, the thing that's interesting, I was discussing with a friend of mine who's actually in the music business, and why these classic rock and mm-hmm. older artists, their catalogs will probably be worth a lot more than current artist catalogs. And we were trying to figure out, like, does Bob Dylan's music, will it resonate for the next 10, 20 years where they can get an ROI on it, as opposed to, let's say, Kanye or Cardi B or, you know, Justin Bieber. And I think that it has a lot to do with those songs remain iconic, A, because they're better songs, and a lot of them are just lyrically more intellectual. So it's easier, because a lot of advertising is very literal, right?
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're singing about the times they are changing, that's applicable for a lot of situations in a product kind of setting, as opposed to just singing about gang life or money or chicks or, you know, in this current climate, are those lyrics as important as Bob Dylan's lyrics?
See, I don't see my, like, my kids in particular, and they grow up, or they've grown up around me, right? So I have, so I play all this stuff. I play modern stuff. I play the Stones. I play Bob Dylan. I think they get a kick out of it. I think they understand it, but I think I also don't, I don't. So the Rolling Stone, I'm reading this right now. It's because these back catalogs in the evergreen era of streaming have the potential to fetch their copyright owners a ton of money in the future. So that's an interesting point here. So basically, Universal bought out future streaming rights for Bob Dylan. He didn't buy it. Bob Dylan could basically make any album he wants for the next, I don't know, 5 more years, however long he has to live. He can do whatever he wants. He can keep writing. But what they own is the future revenue of the songs. So what the bet here on Bob Dylan's part is that $300 million is going to be more valuable today for him and his kids and his, whoever his wife is now, I forget who he's married to, than the kids, Jacob and a couple of the other ones. There's a few of them. The kids getting X amount every year of just royalties on streaming. So that's like it's almost like they bought out his health life insurance. If you remember that clever fintech scam that people do, like getting annuities or whatever.
Well, the one who started this whole thing was actually Bowie.
Mm-hmm.
A few years before his death, and he sold it to, he didn't even sell it really to a management company. He sold it to a hedge fund.
Yep.
And he sold out his whole catalog years and years ago. I guess, you know, for the artist, I guess it's a good play, especially late in your career. I mean, you kind of juxtapose this, what, you know, Taylor Swift just went through and her catalog being sold and all of that stuff. I like it. I mean, ultimately, at the end of the day, as they say, content is king, right? I mean, there's only going to be one Bob Dylan.
Yep.
I think there's going to be multiple Kanye-type guys. And I don't think that artists from this era will ever achieve that kind of notoriety. When you play your kids the songs, did they ever hear of them before? Have they ever heard of them?
No, they've never heard of them. I mean, the fact that they hear it from me is the only thing they know. I mean, that I'm into them is the only reason why they would ever listen to them.
And so, did they enjoy it? Did they seem to like it when they did hear it?
I think so. Like Hey Jude, for example, that's a classic for them. They love that stuff. Stuff that's like really the stuff that people have loved for half a century at this point. Like this is, but even like, my son really enjoyed, Erie Canal. Bruce Springsteen redid that. That's a folk song. So that specific song really, really struck a nerve. He really enjoyed, oddly enough, he enjoyed freaking, it was kind of funny. He enjoyed, Johnny Cash, Teenage Queen. And he actually cried because one time because the Teenage Queen took the girl away from her hometown. If you remember that song. So that was so cute, but it's just like, if I hadn't picked that up and I hadn't shown it to him and I hadn't shared it with him, he would have never listened to it. It's just such a, it's kind of sad, and it's also kind of expected, I guess, at this point.
Oh, as we're fond of calling ourselves, we're old men, right?
Yeah, exactly. Anyway, yeah.
Time marches on.
Yep.
All so right, did you see this thing about Warner Brothers releasing everything on HBO Max?
Yeah, how's that breaking down? So like on the 20th, like as of the 21st.
They're going to release the entire 2021 schedule online and in the movie theaters, I believe. Excuse me, in the movie theaters, I believe, at the same time. Traditionally, the way that works and has been working is that the theater owners get it first. They have like a 30, 60, 90-day window, whatever it is, exclusive. And then it would go over to the streaming services. Mm-hmm. And HBO said, no mas. We're putting all our money into HBO Max. You guys are going out of business. Sorry. And that's that. And AMC, the largest theater company in the United States, they are freaking.
Yeah.
Freaking. So, personally, you know, being a filmmaker myself, being in the entertainment business, even on its periphery, I don't have a problem with movie theaters going away, mm-hmm. truthfully. My sister just got an 85-inch Sony, slapped it on the wall with the mm-hmm. sound bar. And I might as well be in a movie theater.
See, this is the same. Like I'm sitting here next to a turntable, right? And we think we talked about this a few times. I'm sitting next to a turntable. I really enjoy vinyl records now because I like the experience of having a piece of plastic that contains the music as opposed to like streaming something or putting it on Sonos. Are we going to miss that experience? Like grabbing.
I think with movie theaters, the value they brought wasn't the content distribution; it was the social experience.
Mm-hmm.
You need a place to take your new girl on a Friday night. Try yep. and you know put your arm around her shoulder. You need to escape your kids. You need to go see something and have that shared social experience of laughing at the same time, being scared at the same time as other human beings. I think it'll be a tremendous loss from that point of view. And I think that that's sad to see it go. But in terms of delivering the actual content, I don't think that's, you know, that's what... You know, that's not the problem. It's in a way, it's more of a cultural, societal problem than it is an entertainment distribution problem.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that is sad. I mean, there was something to going to a movie theater, like I said, and having a shared experience with other human beings.
Yeah, it's like even leaving the house. I mean, obviously, we can't do that right now, but wouldn't it be nice to have that to I don't know. To be able to go back to that at some point.
Yeah, I mean, I can see what I think will happen is there'll be tremendous consolidation, right? There'll be a lot less theaters,
mm-hmm.
and they're going to have to evolve into that more experiential kind of experience where you're going to go and suddenly a movie ticket is going to cost $30.
Mm-hmm.
40. I can see it being up to $40, $50, truthfully. And I think a fair amount of people would pay it, but it has to be more than just, you know, Wonder Woman on the screen.
Yeah.
I like, there's a couple of theaters by me out in Cali. They have the reclining seats. They have waitress service. You can get food. You can get booze. That kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's the future of theaters.
That's like the Alamo Drafthouse, for example. The idea and the Alamo Drafthouse is quite literally the mental equivalent of my discs here, my little goofy love of vinyl. So mentally, I'm already there. Mentally, I'm, hey, I don't want to listen to the thing on, on the streaming. I want to just pick up a disc and I want to put it on and I want to listen to it that way. And that experience is superior, and I'll pay for that experience. I'll pay extra for that experience. So I think one of the things that I see at the end of this whole pandemic thing specifically is that we do enter into almost a summer of love, let's say. Let's call it a summer love to a degree, where basically everybody goes completely nuts. They're all at out dancing. They all got their concert venues go explode, all this other stuff. So I think if my money is on physical spaces exploding, everybody's going to go back to them, and everybody's going to get naked in a freaking rave in 2022.
I don't disagree with that at all. I think there's going to be a lot of pent up emotion, mm-hmm. a lot of pent up desire for human connection and all of that stuff. And I totally agree with you.
Yep.
But I think it's going to be, less venues, less opportunities to do that. And it'll be a lot more expensive. And I don't think people will care.
Hmm.
I think people would be so desperate for that experience and those experiences, the experiences you just mentioned, that I think they'll pay for it. It's kind of like Broadway. I mean, think about what Broadway will be.
Yep.
Broadway already was $100 a ticket. Broadway could conceivably go to $500 a ticket.
Mm-hmm.
So who knows? There'll be some kind of adjustment. It's not going to go away. And like I said, I agree with you. People are going to be pent up and just looking for this summer of love. When people are healthy again and safe and we can go out and interact with each other. And I guess we'll just see what happens.
All right. Final point. We got Airbnb going public. That seems like a silly idea, but God bless them.
Yeah. I mean, to go public during a lockdown, but
yeah.
They'll raise what's the value of them? Like $95 billion, right? They're looking to raise like $3 billion out of $95-97 billion.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That's another company. I mean, their valuation will what? Make them more valuable than every hotel company in the world combined, I assume.
Yeah, exactly.
Tesla of hotels.
And to a degree, if we're right about our summer of love situation, a company like Airbnb is ready to rock and roll when people come out of this, because you're basically in a situation where like, I want to go live in a tiny house by a river as opposed to by a liver.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, right now it looks, during it looks silly, but as you just said, they'll be poised for growth, I guess. And probably big growth for all the reasons you just mentioned. So,
anyway, all right. Well, this is a quick one. We did this. I feel like this just whizzed past because we had a lot to say about Bob Dylan and
fun subjects. And we're pals now. We have a rhythm.
Well, the Tech Hygiene Pal Hour. We should have buddies doing podcasts. They're just this is our summer of love, really, ultimately, because we never leave the house anyway. So we might as well just create this, create our voices talking to each other in the ether.
Exactly.
This has been Tech Hygiene. I'm John Biggs.
I'm Lauren Feldman.
We will see you next week. Tech Hygiene is brought to you by Typewriter. Typewriter is your on-demand editor, and their amazing team of writers will make your book chapter, blog post, or email shine. Typewriter editors come from places like TechCrunch, Gizmodo, and the New York Times, and they offer low bulk rates for longer work. Check it out at typewriter.plus. That's typewriter.plus.